the impossible choice faced by heroic botanists during Leningrad siege by the Nazis.
They have this decision. Do we eat the seeds? Do we distribute them to the starving people? Or do we deny our hunger and preserve the collection?
That's Simon Parkin. Today, we take a deep dive into two riveting accounts about the siege of Leningrad during World War II. First, Simon Parkin tells us about his book, The Forbidden Garden, the incredible true story of Soviet botanists who protected the world's first seed bank during the Nazi blockade, sacrificing their own lives to preserve biodiversity. Then we revisit my 2015 conversation with M.T. Anderson about his award-winning biography, Symphony for the City of the Dead, a dramatic account of Dmitri Shostakovich and how his Seventh Symphony became a beacon of resistance and hope for the starving city. Together, these stories explore moral courage under the most agonizing duress, where dedication to science and to art rallied the deepest reserves of human resilience. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the summer of 1941, German troops surrounded the Russian city of Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, and began the longest blockade in recorded history. The blockade would ultimately claim the lives of nearly 750,000 people. At the center of the besieged city stood a converted palace that housed the world's largest collection of seeds, more than 250,000 samples hand-collected over two decades from all over the globe by world-famous explorer, geneticist, and dissident Nikolai Vavilov, who had recently been disappeared by the Soviet government. After attempts to evacuate the priceless collection failed and supplies dwindled among the 3 million starving citizens, the workers at the Plant Institute were left with a terrible choice. Should they save the collection or themselves? This dilemma lies at the heart of Simon Parkin's acclaimed book, The Forbidden Garden, The Botanists of Besieged Leningrad and Their Impossible Choice. Simon Parkin is an award-winning British journalist and author. A contributing writer for The New Yorker, he's also written for The Guardian, The New York Times, Harper's Magazine, and other publications. Simon Parkin, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hi, lovely to be here. Thank you.
At the heart of this book, The Forbidden Garden, lies a moral quandary. Whom to save? Help future generations or feed the starving? That's because it's about the siege of Leningrad, the longest blockade in recorded human history, and about the efforts of the scientists of the first seed bank ever to be created to protect the seed stocks during the famine. Let's start with talking about the historical context and one of the key characters in this story. In the story of the seed bank, Nikolai Vavilov. Tell us about him.
Yeah, so Nikolai Vavilov was a botanist, an academic. He lectured. He had students in Saratov in the Soviet Union, and he was also an explorer. And he had an idea that he wanted to amass a collection of every wild variety of plant that he could find. And this combined all of his interests of botany and exploration and travel, all the things that he liked to do. And so he decides to travel to every country he can. He goes all around the world, 5 continents he ends up visiting. And wherever he goes, he introduces himself to farmers, to local academics, to plant breeders, and tries to take samples of their indigenous local plants wherever they are, and then sends them back to the Plant Institute, which he runs in the center of the city that is known variously as Petrograd and St. Petersburg and Leningrad. And he actually takes it over when it's known as Petrograd in 1921. He goes there with 27 of his student colleagues and takes over this very small institute, and over the next 15, 20 years builds it up into this formidable library of living seeds and plants that he collects or wherever he travels and sends back to the city to be experimented on, to be crossbred, and all of the other things that he's interested in.
And why did he establish the seed bank? I mean, what were the circumstances that drove him to do that?
Well, he's actually asked to do it in the first instance. So in early 1921, there's been the revolution has happened in Russia, and Petrograd is in a poor state. And he receives this letter from a fellow scientist who runs, I suppose, what you would call the sort of prototype of the seed bank, inviting him to come and take over the work. And by the time that Vavilov turns up in the city, having taken this huge long train ride across the country with his students, the botanist who wrote him the letter has already fled the city, and they turn up and find so this small institute has been abandoned, and many of the seeds that were there, there were only around 12,000 to 14,000 varieties of seeds when Vavilov turns up, but many of them have been eaten by the starving people in the city. And so their work is really to begin to rebuild and make it a much larger collection than it ever was. And they're motivated by the waves of famine that have taken grip in Russia, really one every 10 years since the late 1800s. So for any Russian at the time, the idea of food security and hunger was always close in the mind. And Vavilov's mission is to try to breed types of varieties of wheat, barley, oat and rye, other crops that are used to make food, and to try to crossbreed them to create varieties that have a higher yield or are particularly resistant to diseases or frost or whatever it might be. And his theory is that hundreds of years earlier, when the early farmers were selecting their seeds to make crops, maybe some wild varieties of wheat, for example, had been overlooked. So he specializes in wild varieties of crops, and that's why he's often found on the top of mountainsides trying to track down these crops to see, basically his theory was, perhaps they would have some genetic qualities that have been overlooked by our ancestors, and he wants to run experiments on them and hopefully uncover some of these traits and through that grow crops that give larger yields or whatever it might be in order to improve Russia's food security with the ultimate aim of eradicating all famine.
So this was a pretty forward-thinking idea, wasn't it? I mean, the idea that you could uncover unusual, you know, resilience in wild varieties.
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly building on the theories that have been around for the past 20, 30 years. But the idea of creating what's described by one newspaper at the time as a living library of all plant matter, that is new. And, you know, having looked around and spoken to seed bank experts, it does seem as though this is the first seed bank of its type. It's the first time that a phrase in Russian similar to the term seed bank is ever used. So, yes, in that sense, the work is pioneering. And certainly there had been nothing at this scale before, almost, you know, semi-industrial scale of, you know, very clear expeditions going to very clearly targeted places in order to track down these samples. And together with his team, they visit Turkestan, India, Afghanistan. They pick flax in Iran and orange on the road to Kabul, and they get as far as Tokyo and Taiwan as well. So the scope of their expeditions are really at an unprecedented scale at that time, yes.
And also another goal, it seems to me, if I remember correctly, is that he understood that habitats were disappearing and also sought to rescue plants that might not any longer have a habitat.
Well, the source of that was in part because of his fame. He was known around the world, and partly that was because he was quite a charming person who travelled a lot, but also he studied in Cambridge in the UK, and he visited America. He became a member of lots of societies, the New York Geographical Society. He was an honorary member of the American Botanical Society as well. And yeah, he was awarded all manner of doctorates and certificates and whatever, society memberships. So he was well known around the world. And I mentioned that the Times of London described the seed bank as the world's first living library of plants. That was in 1933. So that shows, I suppose, the extent to which his work had become famous, certainly in the West at that time. So yeah, there was a certain amount of distrust from Stalin's regime at Vavilov's profile, at the collaboration that he had with foreign scientists. And internally as well, Vavilov suffered by comparison to a rival botanist, Trofim Lysenko, whose theories better resonated with Stalin's communist ideals at the time. Lysenko believed that plants would acquire the characteristics of the environment in which they were planted. So if a particular plant was planted, for example, in a very cold environment, it would acquire the ability to withstand that cold or whatever it might be. Whereas Vavilov's theory was much closer to that of genetic inheritance. So that those qualities were passed down through the generations. And crucially, Lysenko told Stalin that he could increase the food and grain yield in the Soviet Union several years quicker than Vavilov's estimates. So these things all combined, I think, led Vavilov to his star to fall at a certain point. And academics and people who study this debate to what degree his profile fell or his standing fell. But what is undeniable is that in the summer of 1940, Vavilov is out collecting samples on a mountainside near Ukraine when a black car pulls up and three shady-looking characters get out and say, "Vavilov, you're needed with us in Moscow on urgent business." He gets into the car. It turns out that that was a lie, and they were trying to bring him to Moscow so that he could be arrested. And that's indeed what happens. So certainly by 1940, Vavilov was in such a degree of disfavor, as you put it, that he was arrested and tried for he was accused of spying for the British, which was untrue, and sentenced to death.
It was a terrible fate, and yet it took a long time to discover the truth.
Yes, it did. And in fact, his loyal staff members, who are still working away in the center of Leningrad, as the city was known by this point, really work very hard to try to find out what's happened to him. The last they know, he got into this car on a collecting expedition and went to Moscow, and several of them travel to Moscow and make petitions, try to discover what's happened to him, and some of them fall foul of the regime as a result of that. And the invasion of the Soviet Union by the Nazis, it occurs even while most of the staff don't know what's happened to Vavilov, their leader. And so they're left leaderless. And it takes several years before what happens to Vavilov and his ultimate fate starts to emerge. And in fact, the true circumstances of what happened to him aren't discovered until the 1950s and 60s.
It really struck me reading about this, because right now, well, you write in the book, all around him, science seemed ever more deeply politicized. And that's exactly the kind of fate that we're entering into right now. It was just terrifying to read the impact and what happened. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, you know, science is so politicized, particularly in the 1930s in the Soviet Union. And you had to be publishing papers that aligned with the state's points of view and its ambitions and its ideologies. And, you know, scientists who simply wanted to test and pursue the truth and to carry out their experiments and record their findings struggled during this period. And of course, that is always a struggle and a fear for scientific institutions, particularly those that are funded by public money. And yes, certainly in our two countries, that's a pressing issue at the moment.
Oh, in the UK as well?
Well, I mean, yes, it has been, perhaps less so than what the United States is experiencing at the moment, yeah.
Tell us now about the German invasion. It came as a complete surprise to Stalin. How did Leningrad come to be surrounded by the German army?
Well, you say it was a surprise. He had been informed by various spies that he had that it was increasingly likely that Germany was going to renege on its deal that it had with the Soviet Union. So throughout most of 1940, from the invasion of Poland, the two countries had an agreement that they were on the same side. And then that is torn up in the summer of 1941 when this huge amassing of German troops on the Russian border, and they invade the Soviet Union. For whatever reason, Stalin has ignored these warnings. And so they're met with very little resistance from the Red Army. And for this reason, the German troops are able to progress very quickly across Soviet terrain. Of course, the Soviet Union is vast, much bigger than most of us can even imagine. And it does take a long time. And many of the roads that I think the Germans were expecting to be, you know, more suitable for carrying vast numbers of troops and tanks and horses turn out to be little more than dirt roads. But nevertheless, they do reach the suburbs of Leningrad by August 1941, so really within a matter of weeks. And they've had a directive from Hitler that nobody is to advance on the capital of Moscow until Leningrad has been taken. There are various reasons for this, but partly Leningrad is the symbol of the hotbed from which Bolshevism rose. It's also a highly cosmopolitan city with it embodies lots of things that Hitler and his regime are against. So symbolically, they want to take Leningrad out before they then go on and take Moscow out. And so, yes, the German troops work their way through the suburbs and then decide to encircle the city. And rather than try to take it by force and take lots of casualties probably by doing so, they decide to besiege the city and simply wait it out, prevent food and supplies from entering Leningrad, and with the idea that they'll weaken the city and then can go in and they'll be met with very little resistance, which of course is a very, an age-old tactic in military tactic for sieging cities. And the botanists are, in the weeks leading up to the siege and in the very early days of the siege, many of the city's institutions are rushing. They're aware that the Germans are coming. Perhaps the information isn't quite as crystal clear as they would hope, but they do know that the Germans are advancing. And so, for example, the Hermitage Museum, which is across St. Isaac Square, very close to the seed bank, the director of the Hermitage wastes no time at all in crating up all of the priceless artworks that they have there and the valuable gold and other treasures, and they load them onto trains which make it out of the city and take it off to the Ural Mountains where they're stowed for safekeeping. The scientists in the seed bank feel, I think, much less empowered because their director isn't around. They're not getting a clear directive from Moscow on what they should be doing. And so they do start to crate up some of the collection. They have nearly a quarter of a million seeds and samples in their converted palace where they're based, in many of them in little aluminium tins, if you can picture that, in racks and very carefully ordered. And, they look at what's happening at the Hermitage and they say, well, the seeds that we have here are just as valuable. They're the botanical treasures that are maybe irreplaceable as well. So they do start to box those up. But by the time they manage to secure some carriages on one of the trains that's taking supplies out of the city, they do box it up, but the train unfortunately is unable to make it out of the city before the siege ring closes. So the scientists and their collection are trapped inside the city at the beginning of the siege.
You have the most extraordinary descriptions of the bombardment of Leningrad, of the siege of Leningrad. Tell us what it was like for these botanists to be there at that time?
Well, the bombing of the city, the Blitz, begins very early on, and there's a pretty regular barrage of artillery fire and bombs being dropped by German planes that strafe the city. More than 100 of these incendiaries land on the actual institute roof. And so the botanists quite soon arrange a plan to deal with this. Some of them wait on the roof during one of these bombing raids. And whenever an incendiary lands, they kick it off the roof into the courtyard where some of the other botanists are waiting, and they douse the flaming incendiary with sand or whatever it might be and try to put it out as quickly as possible. But as well as bombs, it's not long before everyone is having to contend with the paucity of supplies in the city. Very little food is able to make it into Leningrad. Some of it does come by plane every day, but there are around 3 million people living in the city. And so you can imagine, well, we just have to imagine our own homes and how much food we have in here. And if there were only tiny rations coming in every week, how long might we be able to survive on the dried food that we have in our own cupboards? And so really by November, people are starting to actively starve. They're just simply not taking on enough calories compared to the amount that they're expending. And this is compounded by the very low temperatures. It's a notoriously cold winter, this winter of 1941 to 1942. And you're, of course, burning more calories, trying to keep warm. And as well as the lack of food supplies, people are now having to burn their books and bookshelves, whatever fuel they can find, just to try and heat their homes, to try to keep them warm while they don't have enough food as well. And these problems are affecting the botanists in the seed bank as well. And so they're trying to burn whatever they can, not only to keep themselves warm, but also in some cases to keep their samples warm. So in the basement cellar of the Plant Institute, the botanists have managed to stow around 2 tons of rare potatoes. These were dug up from the suburban plot in Pavlovsk, really just as the German troops are arriving. And 2 very brave botanists managed to dig up some of these samples, put them in burlap sacks and bring them back to the center of the city. And in fact, one of them, Abraham Kamaraz, is knocked unconscious by an artillery shell while he's digging up the potatoes. He comes to and manages to make it to the city. They put the potatoes in the cellar, as I say, but the risk is if the temperatures drop below freezing that the potatoes will perish. And so as well as heating themselves, they're trying to find enough wood to keep a stove going in the cellar in order to keep the potatoes alive as well. And at a certain point, the citizens of Leningrad begin to, unfortunately, slaughter their pets. So any cats or dogs, sometimes they trade with their neighbors to make it less difficult, and eat those animals. And this has the knock-on effect that there's a huge surge of vermin in the city. And these rats and mice can smell the seeds in the institute off St. Isaac Square. And so in the first winter, the institute is assaulted by waves of rats who are trying to get into the rooms where the botanists have stowed the seeds. They're trying to get into the tins, knock them onto the floor and chew through them. And so the botanists have to take these measures while they're wasting away, tying together the tins. They take pieces of tin off the roof and hide the aluminium tins under these sheets of metal just to try and stop the rats from getting to them. And when the rats are unable to get in and get any of the seeds, they then start chewing the furniture and the documents and other things that they have. So it's really a bleak time that's also quite physically demanding.
It's excruciating to read about this, and it's so important too to understand the reality of a siege of this kind. I think the kind of description, Simon Parkin, that you give in this book is so valuable, because people really don't understand what things are really like unless it's described in this way. What were some of your sources in order to bring this time alive?
Well, there were sort of two sets of sources that I'm trying to work from. Firstly, the diaries and memoirs of people who lived through the siege. Now, there are thousands of these memoirs and diaries, so it's a very large body of material that you can read through, and many of them are day-by-day accounts of what it was like living in the city. For example, Olga Berlotz, the poet, has wonderful descriptions. I say wonderful, I mean in the literary sense. Of course, they're harrowing, the material, but, you know, very detailed and well-written. Lydia Ginsberg as well, perhaps the finest writer who was living in during the siege, has a book as well that was a very valuable source. And yeah, there are so many documents. It was really a deciding which ones I was going to read through and then what details to include. On the other hand, there's a paucity of material from the botanists themselves who were living through this. Almost none of them kept diaries, apart from the dates and times of when incendiary bombs landed on the roof, for example, which were recorded. But in terms of the memories of what it was like week to week inside those dark and corridors and rooms, there's very little. There are some accounts that they wrote later in the 1950s that were published. These tend to be, and in fact, all of these accounts you have to read with one eye on when they were published and perhaps what self-censorship might have been going on because of when they were published, because that would have been a reality for, you can imagine, in the 1950s, writing about perhaps the poor decisions that were made by Leningrad's management or by the regime is a perilous thing to do. So the whole time you're searching for the truth behind, perhaps in between the lines of what is written, along with just the basic factual detail. The seed bank is still there in the city that is now known as St. Petersburg. And I was helped by an archivist there who very kindly photocopied, scanned, printed documents, things that have been written subsequently after the war by people who lived through it, who worked there, and sent all of those to me. So, yeah, it was a strange sort of dichotomy of having so much material from just the general public and then really trying to grab every morsel I could from the people who actually worked at the seed bank itself.
Right. And what were those poor decisions? Because you point out, yes, on the one hand, there was the invasion of the Germans. But on the other hand, I think you even quote somebody who says that had not the regime made the mistakes that it did, and actually had not the rationing been done so unequally that most people who starved in the Leningrad siege would not have starved.
Yes, that's certainly one of the arguments that has subsequently been made. So if you were a worker, there was just a great deal of preferential treatment depending on what your job was. And I think for the ordinary citizen, it was much, much harder. And then, you know, if you worked in certain institutions or if you were, you know, in one of the places where food was given out, or if you were a member of the state management of the city's governors or whatever, then you had a surplus of food, even while people are starving outside. There were also poor decisions made to... There's one notorious fire that happened early on in the bombing of Leningrad, where the city's food stores and sugar stores, these warehouses, caught fire. And that really took out a huge amount of the city's food stocks. If those had been better distributed around the city, then that would have been avoided. And in fact, in the end, people are picking through the embers of the rubble from those fires, just trying to find bits of melted sugar or whatever they can later on in the siege. So, you know, that shows the level of desperation and also just some of these poor managerial decisions that were made. I think just things happened too late as well. And that can often occur when there's not there's not enough clarity over the true military situation. How quickly the German army was advancing was kept from many of Leningrad's citizens. So it did come as a surprise. So they perhaps weren't able to prepare in the way that they would have been had they been better informed. And of course, the control of information and disinformation was, you know, one of the characteristics of this period for ordinary citizens. And, you know, it was deadly in the case of the Siege of Leningrad.
And so now let's talk about the central question and issue of the book, and that is why the botanists saved the seeds rather than save, in many cases, their own lives. Why did they decide to do that?
Yeah, this is the deep question that I try to wrestle with in the book. It seems like quite a clear choice that they had, because they have 250,000 plants, seeds and samples, many of which were edible. There were, you know, almonds and nuts and, of course, the potatoes, all manner of other things that could have prolonged the lives of the workers in the institute and the lives of the starving citizens outside in the city. And so they have this decision: do we eat the seeds? Do we distribute them to the starving people? Or do we deny our hunger and preserve the collection so that when the siege hopefully eventually breaks, we can resume our scientific work, we can plant out the fields, we can renew the collection, and nothing will be lost? That decision, of course, carries with it huge consequences. And because the scientists do decide among themselves, there are some descriptions of arguments, particularly from more junior members of the staff, who say this is ridiculous. We have, in some cases, a duplicate set of seeds. So that we're not just preserving one set of, for example, peas. We've also got a duplicate backup collection. Why don't we just eat the backup collection? But the more senior members of staff say, no, you know, the reason we have the duplicate, the backup, is in case the first one fails, and then we still, our work can continue. And so they do together make the decision that they're not going to touch the collection. And it does have these terrible consequences. And at least 19 of the botanists and workers at the Plant Institute perish as a result of that choice, some of them while still working at their desks. So on the 25th of December of 1941, Dr. Nikolai Ivanov is making his rounds of the Institute and knocks on the office door of his colleague, Alex Stuchkin, who is a groundnut expert, opens the door and sees Alexander at his desk, not moving, and Ivanov goes over, shakes him on the shoulder, and it's clear that Alexander has died. But as Ivanov shakes him, this packet of almonds spills out of his Shutskin's hand and spills onto the desk, and it's clear that he had been clutching these and cataloguing these almonds just at the moment that he had died. So I think that really demonstrates the resolve here of the scientists, that they would, you know, even while still handling these samples that must have been so tempting to eat, that they made that choice not to. And I think that it can be difficult for us to understand why they would make such a mortal choice. And it's something that I wrestle with in the book. There's, and other people have as well in the years subsequently. In fact, in the 1970s, a journalist visits two of the survivors from the Plant Institute and says to them that exact question: why would you abstain from eating these things that could have saved everyone's lives? And one of the botanists says, well, you know, you're a writer. Imagine that you'd spent 10 years working on a book and you have this manuscript. It's the only copy of your work that you've spent all this time on, and you're freezing to death and you're faced with this decision: do I burn my book, this one manuscript I have, in order to save my life, or do I not do that? And he says, well, maybe now you can understand why we made the decision that we did. And to us, it didn't feel like a decision at all.
Yes. So was it worth it? What is the legacy of the Leningrad Seed Bank?
It can be difficult to quantify exactly, you know, what the benefits of the decision were. And it's certainly true that a lot of the collection failed even after the war. So when it's when they go to plant it out and try to renew it, the plants and seeds don't take. And so there were failures, certainly. But we also do know that by the late 1960s, 100 million acres of Russian agricultural land had been planted with seeds that came from the collection that had been saved. And by 1979, that area had almost doubled. And today, 90% of the seeds and crops held in St. Petersburg are found in no other scientific collections in the world. And that certainly wouldn't be true if they hadn't made the decision that they did.
Well, it's just an absolutely searing account, and I think one that is absolutely gripping. Simon Parkin, your book is The Forbidden Garden, The Botanists of Besieged Leningrad and Their Impossible Choice, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us about this important book.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Simon Parkin. Find a link to an audio excerpt from The Forbidden Garden at writersvoice.net. Next up, how Dmitri Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony rallied the spirit of the people of Leningrad during the depths of the siege. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Back in 2015, I spoke with author M.T. Anderson about his book Symphony for the City of the Dead, Dmitri Shostakovich and the Siege of Leningrad. It tells the story of how the Seventh Symphony inspired the resistance of the people of Leningrad to that brutal siege. Let's listen to an extended excerpt of that conversation now. It's Leningrad, 1941. The German army has laid siege to the city and people are dying of starvation. Consider this. More people will die during the siege of Leningrad than Americans in all wars combined. Hitler declared his intention to utterly annihilate the city, the cultural heart and soul of Russia, and he nearly succeeded. But as my guest M.T. Anderson shows in his terrific new book, Symphony for the City of the Dead, the weakening morale of the people was rallied by a great piece of music. It was Dmitri Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, the so-called Leningrad Symphony. He wrote it as the bombs fell around him. It was smuggled out on a perilous journey by air, played in America, and broadcast around the world. The symphony told a story that inspired the beleaguered people of Leningrad and let the world know what was happening to them at the hands of the German army. Anderson's book is written for a teenage readership, but it's a thrilling read for adults as well. Filled with photographs and graphic art, Symphony for the City of the Dead recounts the story of one of Leningrad's greatest native sons, Dmitri Shostakovich. Through that story, we find out about the Russian Revolution, its revolutionary art movements, and Stalin's repression of those movements. But the most gripping part is the incredible story of survival of the people of Leningrad during one of the most vicious military sieges in all of history, and the part Shostakovich's symphony played in that survival. Well, M.T. Anderson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, I'm so delighted to be here.
This book, Symphony for the City of the Dead, this is just a terrific book from so many points of view, really a book about art and politics and history, a wonderful biography of Shostakovich. What got you interested in this story to begin with?
Well, I mean, I think for one thing, since I was a teenager, I had loved the music of Shostakovich. I mean, it's weirdly enough, it's great music for teens in the sense that it's very passionate, it's very dark, it's very ironic, sarcastic. But I think more importantly, I had heard these connected stories about his Seventh Symphony, the Leningrad Symphony, written in 1941. So those stories were these. First of all, I had heard that Shostakovich was stuck in the city of Leningrad during the siege, which when the Germans surrounded the city of Leningrad, and it was the longest siege in recorded history, lasted several years. Shostakovich escaped before, you know, it was over. But while he was there, he wrote most of this symphony in the city while acting as a fireman on the conservatory roof. He was supposed to put out incendiary bombs if they fell. He was lucky, and the building was never hit. But so he was watching up there, writing the symphony at the same time. And then I heard also that it had been put onto microfilm and flown through this eccentric route, first flown to Tehran, then driven through the deserts of the Middle East to Cairo, and flown across northern Africa to the U.S., where it was actually performed as a way of interesting Americans in the Soviet cause, because we were newly allied with the Russians. Before that, we had held them very much at arm's length, for actually quite good reasons. So this was supposed to be, the symphony was supposed to convince Americans, these are people who are not only our allies, but they are people like us, suffering like us, and they are producing art even in the harshest circumstances. That was the second thing I'd heard. And then the third thing I'd heard was this bizarre story that the symphony was performed in the city of Leningrad then, while it was still under siege, in the summer of 1942. And that the score was taken back into the city, and they formed an orchestra by literally going door to door, finding people who, everyone was starving to death. There was hardly any food was getting into the city. There was no electricity, all this kind of thing. They found people, musicians, starving to death in their apartments, and said to them, look, we're going to give you extra rations if you will play this massive symphony. And they gathered together an orchestra and performed it in August of 1942. And that night that they performed it, the army actually, the Red Army, actually bombed the Germans on the opposite side of the city to draw German fire away from the concert hall where this all happened. And there in that concert hall, you know, they played this piece for soldiers, for the party leaders, all this kind of thing, and they broadcast it through the streets and into people's apartments, and they broadcast it towards the Germans across no man's land with the idea that it was kind of a big, you know, screw you to the Germans. Like, here you are trying to starve us into obliteration. You're treating us like animals. And yet, in the middle of this, we still are producing art.
It's an incredible story. What was the response of the people to this? Now, they knew that this symphony was being written because Shostakovich had announced it. So talk about the response of the people of Leningrad to this symphony.
Well, it was overwhelming because they knew that to some extent their story was not being told nationally. So, for example, when a poet who was someone who Shostakovich was friends with, Olga Bergholz, when she left the city at one point during the siege and went to speak in Moscow, she was specifically told, do not tell people about the starvation in Leningrad. You know, it's very typical for the Soviet news service to conceal pieces of information that might make the government look bad or might make the situation look more dangerous than it is. So people were not nationally allowed to talk about the suffering of Leningrad. People had a sense, especially Leningraders who'd fled the city, knew that something must be, you know, it must be terrible, the conditions must be terrible, but they didn't actually have hard evidence of it. So the thing is, I think for people in the city, they embraced this symphony because it really told their story. And not only that, it's actually quite a triumphant symphony. Shostakovich had written very sort of like depressing symphonies before with a lot of defeat and anger in them. The Eighth Symphony, his next one, would have a lot of kind of wartime atrocity behind it. But at the same time, the Seventh is a triumphant symphony, and the reason that was important is that all these people trying to just fight to stay alive and fight to stay human in this broken city of Leningrad, they actually, in hearing this, heard the story of victory that might be possible. I think that was the real secret. They heard a victory that might be possible, and they could see themselves cast in the roles of heroes. They no longer were outcasts. They no longer were, you know, the animals who were eating, like, wallpaper paste and that kind of thing in these frigid apartments. Now they were the ones who were going to stand up to the Germans, and that made a huge psychological difference. It really changed the morale of the city.
When you say it's triumphant, I mean, it's more than that. I actually listened to it yesterday, and I have to say this book has introduced me to Shostakovich. And the music is quite wonderful. But it's not just triumphant. There is an incredible motif that you refer to in this book, in Symphony for the City of the Dead, M.T. Anderson. You refer to the scuttling of the rats, the scuttling of the iron rats. Describe that, and then go on to talk more about how a piece of music can actually express the soul of what's going on.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a part of this symphony that in the first movement. So, you know, symphonies are typically broken up into several movements, each one of which has its own sort of design. And this symphony is kind of like if you picture four giant, beautifully done, like arty propaganda posters or something that are supposed to be kind of like lined up together. This symphony, you know, it's a massive, massive piece. And the structure of the first movement, in a sense, tells a story. You know, it sets out like any symphony would in a very traditional way, with having these particular themes that are played, that have a relationship to each other, and it seems like it's going to be a very traditional symphonic form, which was very common in Russia at the period and that kind of thing. And suddenly then it's interrupted. Right at the moment when you would usually have a development of some themes that came before, instead, everything stops dead, and you have this irritating little march theme. It sounds like it's very far in the distance, and it's very cutesy. It's not at all threatening. It really is kind of like twee and irritating even. And so this is going on in the distance, and it is repeated again and again for about 7 or 8 minutes, depending on how quickly they take it, getting louder and louder and louder and more ferocious. And as it's repeated, this irritating march finally becomes kind of like bestial and kind of blows apart finally into this this panorama of evil, in a sense. And so a lot of people at the time, for very good reason, heard in this the distant approach of the Germans and the way that the Germans swept across Russia so quickly in the first weeks of the Great Patriotic War, that is to say, in late June, early July, August of 1941. Mm. So they heard in this the kind of the encroaching approach of the Germans and the encirclement of the city, and therefore it really did seem to tell the story of their beleaguered town surrounded by the Nazis.
Of course, this symphony played such a key role, as you point out in your book, Symphony for the City of the Dead, Dmitri Shostakovich and the Siege of Leningrad. So, M.T. Anderson, you mentioned Stalin. There's a lot more to this book than just talking about this amazing symphony. You really do talk about the whole society, first the revolution and Shostakovich's place within that, a place that went through various vicissitudes. Let's go back a little bit to the early years of the revolution. You speak a lot about the incredible artistic fervent of the time, the controversies over art. Give us a snapshot of what it was like. What was, you know, Shostakovich's early artistic environment?
Yeah, well, it was an incredibly exciting time in Russia right after the revolution. I mean, it was harrowing, as everyone says at the time. I mean, there was a civil war that went on for a long time, very, very bloody, and a lot of problems with getting food and that kind of thing in that period, too. But at the same time, there was this peculiar sense that the ancient yoke had been thrown off. as many of their revolutionary songs proclaimed, and that, in fact, this was a shining world of the future that they were leading to, that, sure, things were going to be tough for a few years, but then, honestly, they were going to arrive in this sort of utopian state. And the arts really picked that up. I think that, I mean, a lot of the artists started to say, well, look, we want to show our solidarity with the working people and with the peasantry. And I think for many artists, this was a, you know, an honest-to-God pledge. I mean, they really did want to do that. And so what they decided was, well, we need to create a new kind of art, a new kind of writing, a new kind of music, which throws away the forms of the past. All of those forms that are about, you know, the beautiful St. Petersburg beneath the Tsars, and the way that the wealthy could only afford the arts. No, we need to create a new kind of art for the people. And oddly enough, what this did is it took Russia from being kind of the cultural laggard in Europe, the one who felt medieval in many cases, suddenly to the forefront. And boom, you know, futurism, which was a sort of a worldwide movement at the time celebrating, you know, machinery, activity, motion, war, in fact, mechanization, that kind of thing, suddenly this was taken up as a major idea by all of these artists and writers and painters and musicians. And so you get an incredibly different kind of art around that time. And, you know, it actually starts right before the First World War in around 1910, 1914, and then it flourishes in 1920, because that is when everyone is starting to say, look, we have changed the world. We really are going to change how things are done fundamentally in human society. So it was an incredibly exciting time. And Shostakovich, growing up as a teenager in the 1920s, was part of this. I mean, he was writing music sort of on the forefront of the musical avant-garde, even as a kid, as a, you know, a 17, 18, 19-year-old. His first symphony, which got worldwide fame, was performed first when he was 19. So anyway, he sees all of this activity and thinks, this is going to be the future. The future is going to be people turning out these pieces that sound like nothing we've ever had before, because the past has to be thrown away and a new world has to be sought. Incredibly exciting. And the only problem was that, you know, of course, for one thing, Lenin, even though he pretended to be excited about all this experimentation, was actually very wary of public intellectuals because he needed them to be mouthpieces. He did not like them to deviate. And then Stalin was even more like that, and you started to also have a lot of pushback where people were going, no, wait a second, all of this experimentation with, you know, these painters like, you know, Kandinsky and Malevich and all these, this is all too obscure, and this is very much sort of something for an elite. Strangely enough, even while people are talking about the proletariat, they are creating art that you have to have training to understand. And whereas some of the artists, like the composer Roslovets, who grew up as a peasant and became a revolutionary musician, kind of like the Russian Schoenberg or something, he, for example, is saying, well, no, I mean, instead what we need to do is actually educate people so that we have the most educated workforce in the world able to partake of all the fruits of culture. But not everyone agreed with him, and Stalin definitely disagreed with him, and gradually, towards the end of the 1920s and then throughout the 1930s, there were more and more systems to shut down and oppress those who were trying these sort of these exciting new forms. The age of experimentation ended, and instead you had this terrifying reign finally by the late 1930s of kind of a cultural revolution, a cultural oppression, socialist realism. And that was a very, very different time.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that revolution needs artists. But once a revolution is consolidated, the issue is totalitarianism, really, the difference between revolution and totalitarianism. You know, then the artists had to be controlled. How did
Right, and that's a beautifully said distinction. That really is it. That is a beautifully said distinction, right.
So Shostakovich, you know, was, of course, creating. He was famous, as you say, from the time he was a teen. He was a kind of prodigy. His fourth symphony was heard by Stalin, and he came under tremendous pressure because of this. A piece was written in the newspaper calling it a mess instead of music.
And it wasn't the Fourth Symphony. The Fourth Symphony was actually suppressed entirely and was not played at the time because there was too much danger, and the orchestra was very nervous. Everyone was nervous. So the Fourth Symphony actually was suppressed, and the world only heard symphonies 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, you know, that kind of thing. Well, the piece in question is actually an opera called Lady Macbeth of Pzensk District, and it was a piece about a murderess and her career out in the provinces. So this opera was incredibly popular when Shostakovich first premiered it. It was seen as the great hope of Soviet opera. Everyone was crowing about it, even party members. The Communist Party was very, very positive about it. But then one night in 1936, Stalin went to see it. And we don't know exactly what happened. We don't know exactly what it is that he hated about it. And people argue a lot about what it was that he disliked about it. But the point is that he walked out partway through. And just a couple of days later, as Shostakovich is traveling around on a piano tour, he stands in line for an issue of Pravda, the big national newspaper, and there is an article about him, a whole article about him, unsigned, which means that it's also essentially coming from the party. It's a direct party directive in a way. And it says, yeah, just like what you said, it said this music is neurotic, it is more like noise than it is music, it is a mess. And the article ends by saying, in a very threatening tone, this is a game that may end very badly. And this was clearly a threat to Shostakovich, and immediately everyone understands that this is a warning shot being fired across the bow of all of the intellectuals and the creative people of the Soviet Union. This is a warning where Stalin is saying, look, we've got to draw in, to pull in a little bit more. You cannot have the kind of experimentation, you know, that you did back in the previous decade. And things had already shut down a lot by then, but this was even more acute. I mean, now you really, you know, I mean, Shostakovich himself was clearly being followed by the secret police. His conversations were being reported and written down to create a dossier on him for possible destruction. Friends of his were arrested and tortured and killed. His family members, several of them, were arrested and ended up in labor camps. Some of them died in labor camps. So it was a terrifying time for him. He considered suicide, but at the time, his wife was pregnant, and clearly, thank God, you know, the sense of hope in that new life, apparently, you know, it must have been that saved Shostakovich's life. We don't know exactly why he didn't commit suicide, but he did consider it. But after the birth of his daughter, he seems to have sort of gotten back onto the path of and has decided to be a fighter, decided in some way to write music in the face of this criticism. And that was then an incredibly difficult time for him, though, because how do you write music that will somehow please the party when you know that if you make any missteps, you could well end up in prison or even dead? And so that was the next challenge for him.
That was M.T. Anderson talking with me in 2015 about his book, Symphony for the City of the Dead, Dmitri Shostakovich and the Siege of Leningrad. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to the complete conversation. To the complete conversation. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests at writersvoice.net. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.